This is Jim Hightower. You're listening to Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from Costa Rica, bringing you the world from the people's perspective.
Hi, this is Scott Fratcher with Allison Thompson for Radio for Peace International. Radio for Peace International covered the 2003 Soul Fest in Joplin, California. This is David Orr's speech at the 2003 Soul Fest. Radio for Peace International broadcasts messages of hope on international shortwave from Costa Rica. You can access Radio for Peace International and see how you can support Radio for Peace or find out more about the IPC, Institute for Progressive Communications, courses taught on the grounds of Radio for Peace International at the Radio for Peace website, and that is www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. Now, stay tuned for David Orr's speech at 2003 Soul Fest.
Come on in and sit down under the tents, because we have recently barnstormed the country for the environment. Several dozen journals have published his articles about biophilia, sustainability, and his theme of environmentalism as a question of ethical design. Two of David's books, Earth and Mind and Ecological Literacy, have become bestsellers in the academic trade. His latest book, which comes out in February of 2004, is entitled The Corruption of Patriotism in the Age of Terror. This book has been fermenting in his mind since 9/11, and he states that the main purpose of the book is to encourage the permanent retirement for George Bush. Meanwhile, back at home in Oberlin College in Ohio, David chairs the Environmental Studies program. He teaches and advises students and oversees the Adam Joseph Lewis Environmental Studies Center. He's supervised the evolution from the initial charrette to the groundbreaking. He raised most of the funds for the project as well, and it's kind of like a solar living center on the East Coast. It's a beautiful place. I think it was designed by Bill McDonough. David grew up in rural Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, where he spent his unusual childhood in the forests and the fields. Place and landscape exist for him as interior bedrock, what he would call mindscape. Most of us don't have the advantage to come at age in such a natural setting. David believes that children raised in ecologically barren settings are deprived of the sensory stimuli and the kind of imaginative experience that can only come from biological richness. Out of the verdant land of David's youth grew an intense love and respect for the earth. He likes to quote Stephen Jay Gould, who said, "We will not fight to save what we do not love." David believes that what he loves is at great risk and in dire need of salvation. He's dedicated his life to ensuring that future generations develop that love for the earth that will ultimately sustain it. I'm very honored today to bring to the Soulfest stage David Orr.
You know, I'm from Cloudy, Ohio, and it's flat. And come out to California, this is an amazing place. I don't think people ought to get paid to live here. You ought to be paid to live in places like Ohio. Nice to be here. And what I'd like to do is talk for a few minutes about politics. And I want to start with some history. And what we know and the things on which we have been right for a long time. 1950, under Harry Truman, the Paley Commission issued a report on U.S. energy. And the summary of it was that we needed to make a transition to solar. That was 1950. That's a long time ago. In 1973 and 1979, we got hit by two oil embargoes. And what we should have learned in those oil embargoes was that we were vulnerable. We were terribly vulnerable. We now import more oil than we did in 1973 and 1979. About the same time, E.F. Schumacher wrote a little book called Small is Beautiful. And what we learned in that was that the scale of technology is a variable. It's not a given. There's no economies of scale to nuclear power. There's no economy of scale to the oil business. It all needs to go. In 1976, well, you can applaud if you want. I mean, 1976, Amory Lovins wrote a little paper called The Road Less Traveled about soft energy paths. And in that paper, Amory, in projecting out what was U.S. oil and energy scenarios, it was common currency at the time to believe that we would use about 140 quadrillion BTUs of energy about 1990. Amory looked at the numbers, went to the other side of the supply-demand equation and said, no way, no how. You can't afford it, you can't do it, it wouldn't work anyway. Amory was right. If you look back at the numbers from 1976 until the year 2000, you realize even Amory Lovins had understated it. But we should have learned that the price of energy and its true cost weren't the same thing. And there was a whole other path to go. You can see it all around here. There was what Amory called a soft path. We could distribute energy systems to households and rooftops and fields, and there was a whole other way to think about energy. We didn't learn that. 1979, Three Mile Island. And if we hadn't noticed before, we should have noticed then that nuclear power can't be made safe. We don't know what to do with the waste. We still don't know what to do with the waste in the year 2003. Nuclear power needs to go. In Ohio, I live about 50 miles as a sober crow would fly it from a plant by the name of Davis Bessie near Toledo, Ohio. By accident, workers discovered a softball-sized hole in the crown of the reactor core. It wasn't planned maintenance. They just discovered it by accident. Somebody leaned against a pipe and the whole thing fell through. How close it was to a nuclear meltdown, we don't know. But it was a lot closer than we'd like. If we hadn't thought about it or learned it, by 1995, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climatic Change had reported that the human signature was now evident on climate. You could tell that we're driving climate into a whole different regime. Now, this is interesting because the words global warming are used to describe what's going on. This isn't global warming. This is planetary destabilization. The theory has it you can turn the temperature of the planet up just a little bit and nothing else wobbles over here. But that's not the world you read about in the morning paper or see in the evening news. That's a world where small changes here have large effects over here. Global warming, it's real. It's happening. The question is, where do we stop it? At what point? Is it 400 parts per million CO2 or 450 or 500? And then there's another little thing here. We know now that climate doesn't change gradually. It changes as kind of a step-level function, abrupt changes. But everywhere the anecdotal evidence is gathered, it supports the theory that we're pushing climate into a brand new state. Ice is melting, sea levels rising, the number of anomalous climate events is rising. The World Meteorological Association reported about a month ago that they could no longer predict weather. It's now too unstable. Hottest hots, driest dries, wettest wets, lowest lows. Everywhere you look, climate is changing. If we hadn't learned anything from 9/11, there was a lot to be learned. We should have learned that climate policy, energy policy, economic policy, security policy, and equity aren't different issues. They are different facets of one big issue, the conduct of the public policy. We still treat these as if they are separable. Quick story. I was asked in the summer of 2001, before 9/11, to go with some Republican businessmen to the White House. And the invitation came from a man who had been in the first Bush administration. And I listened to it, and I said, well, Bo, why me? He said, well, David, you have a reputation of being a sane environmentalist. Now, I've been called worse, but I can't tell you when. And my mother, who lived in North Carolina at the time and spoke the sweetest southern drawl you've ever heard, and she's a right-wing Republican. And I called my mother. I just wanted to let her know that my life hadn't been a total waste. And I said on the phone, said, Mom, some of your friends invited me to go to the White House. I expected her to be happy, but she said, why? And I said, well, Mom, they think I'm a sane environmentalist. They think I can help something. Long pause. She said, well, honey, they just don't know you like I know you. Cut her off my Christmas card list. 9/11 wasn't what we made it to be. It should not have been interpreted as an act of war. That was a police action. We dealt with Milosevic and Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, none of whom have been caught. By the way, Michael Moore's next movie comes out. It's about the Bush family relations with the bin Ladens in Saudi Arabia. Now, this history lesson, and there's a lot more to be said, this history lesson really points out that our energy policy will drive climate into brand new directions. It can't be made fair. It can't be made sustainable. It can't be the basis on which we build any kind of lasting prosperity. Not now, not ever. It'll enrich a few for a time, but that's all it will do. It will lead to war. It will lead to more terrorism. And I think it will take us to fascism. That's where we're headed, unless we stop it. Now, some of you, John Schaefer and many of you, tens of thousands of people around the world, have been making a different kind of energy policy. We know, after 30 years, that solar works. We know that efficiency works. We know that you can generate power from windmills. We know these things. Now, this leads me to a conclusion. We don't have an energy problem. We have a political problem. What's the nature of the political problem? Well, let me give you what I think is, I wrote down some notes this morning. Here's what I think the essence of it is. There are several decks of playing cards going around. John handed me a different deck over here. This is a deck that I bought, or somebody sent me several weeks ago. This is, what's his name? George Bush. And this is the, he's the ace of spades on here. Now, the political problem starts at the very top, and let me just read this. This is a quote from Bob Woodward in Bush at War. I am the commander, see? I don't need to explain. I do not need to explain why I say things. That's the interesting thing about being the president. Maybe somebody needs to explain to me why they say something. But I don't feel like I owe anybody an explanation. That's our commander-in-chief. The first part of the political problem is arrogance at the very top of the system. I don't have to explain. I don't owe anybody an explanation. We still have not been told who was in the room when Dick Cheney made U.S. energy policy. That is still classified information. Why is that classified? Is this not a democracy? We're just going to have audience participation. You know, y'all take a number. Let me give you a second reason. You know it as well as I do, or better. The second part of the political problem we have is the power of money in politics. We ought to get money out of politics in the same way we reportedly have gotten religion out. There ought to be a clear separation between church and state and between money and the state. And money explains a great many things. How is it, you tell me, how is it you take the morality of the robber barons, the vision of Calvin Coolidge, the foreign policy sensitivities of Genghis Khan, and make that national policy. It takes a lot of money to do that. I sit on a couple of foundation boards, and one of the problems with foundations that fund progressive things is that we scatter lots of money around to lots of different organizations. The right wing doesn't make that mistake. They give large amounts in over many years to a small number of organizations. I've got a third reason why I think we have a political problem, or a third dimension of the political problem. This is the corruption of language. And if you don't read George Orwell, read George Orwell. He had it right. If you want to corrupt a nation, the first thing you do is to corrupt its words. Now, you tell me how the word patriot came to be applied to people driving their SUV to the mall with two America flags and a God Bless America bumper sticker. How did that become patriotic? After 9/11, we weren't asked to sacrifice anything. We were asked to buy. Imagine how that would have gone down with Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt or any other great president. How'd the word conservative come to apply to people who are merely reckless and intend to conserve nothing but the rules of the game?
This is Tim Desmond, the Sea Ball Guy, and you're listening to Radio for Peace in Costa Rica.
You are listening to Radio for Peace International and a speech by David Orr, given at the 2003 Soul Fest in Hopland, California. Radio for Peace International is facing a lockout similar to the one faced by Pacifica not too long ago. To find out how you can help or support Radio for Peace International, log on to our website at www.rfpi.org. www.rfpi.org. And now back to David Orr.
This is Jim Hightower. You're listening to Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from Costa Rica, bringing you the world from the people's perspective.
This is Julia Butterfly Hill with listener-supported Radio for Peace International, your global community forum.
How is it that the word liberal, a good word, became so corrupted? Do you remember that point? If you're old enough, you'll remember the debate with Dukakis and George Bush in 1988. And George Bush Sr. had accused Michael Dukakis of being a liberal, the L word. And it was just like time was suspended for just a moment. And there was a long pause, and you wanted Michael Dukakis to say, yeah, I'm a liberal, I'm proud of it. And here's what that word means, and you're a liberal too. Liberal has a long and noble tradition. How did we lose that word? How is it we can't talk about liberalism anymore, even in a society that is manifestly liberal? And tell me, how did the word government become a bad word? Why is it we want to get government off our backs and put it in our bedrooms? How is it, or why is it, we want to get government off our backs but leave corporations there? Unaccountable power. Take back our language. Take back our words. We can't save this country unless we can speak authentically. Now, let's get real down and dirty and personal here. Part of the problem is us. Progressives. We are divided up into all kinds of factions, sub-factions, factions of factions. David Brower once said that progressives are prone to draw the wagons in a circle and shoot inward. And while we've been getting in touch with our inner child, a good thing to do, they've been getting in touch with Middle America. They're down at the truck stop. They're on the airwaves. We don't have anybody, Jim Hightower and a few other folks, but we don't have anybody to counter Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh thinks all this stuff is all environmental wackos. And we don't have a counter to that. We need to be out there at the truck stops, out on the airwaves. We need to become political. There's a lesson. I'm a professor, so everything looks to me like a kind of a lecture opportunity, and that's bad. But 19th century European socialists were divided up into all kinds of factions. Read that history. And by the time the world was ready for better ideas about how to organize its affairs, what we got out of all those factional disputes was Bolshevism. And the rest, as they say, is history. Pay attention to history. My fifth reason, or fifth aspect of the political problem, is sheer forgetfulness. I'm going to be political here in a way that may offend, has already offended at least one person, but let's be honest about this. Who gave us Watergate? Who gave us Iran-Contra? Who gave us the impeachment of a duly elected president, whether you like him or not? Who gave us a budget shutdown? Who gave us massive deficits in the 80s and now again in the 21st century? Who gave us a stolen election? We need to pay attention. Some people are counting on us forgetting our own history, not being able to get the name of things right. Remember, nothing older than last week. We need a memory. We need a sense of history. We need to know where we've been. We need to know why we've gotten where we've gotten. My sixth point is simply the kind of confusion that is engendered in American society, and I don't think it's an accident. We spend about $350 billion, we're told, to lie to each other with advertising. The average American, I'm told, spends about 4 hours and some minutes watching television, not a totally healthy activity. We are confused. 42% of the American public thinks that we found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. A similar number believes that Iraq was directly behind the events of 9/11. We are a confused people. We have been dumbed down. We need to be able to connect the dots, see patterns and systems. This is an educational crisis. Now, let me close out with what do we do? It's easy to diagnose things. We are in a political problem. But make no mistake about it, the whole solar issue, the environmental issue, needs to be politicized in a way that honors our future, the dignity of our children, honors ecosystems, lands. Our future is in jeopardy. The first thing we have to do is to make solar and energy the keystone issue, the linchpin issue of American politics. It's the biggest thing going on. We can't make it. We can't make it to a decent future on the path we're now walking. We have to change paths. It cannot be a fringe movement. The day needs to come when that highway out here is clogged. When you have Soul Fest in a couple of years, you almost need not to be able to get here. There needs to be that many people. Then we need Soul Fest in Ohio and Alabama and Minnesota. We need a solar revolution. But we're not going to get it unless we get really, really good at politics. And that's hard work. That means understanding what the CAFE standards are. Why is it that the corporate average fuel efficiency standard hasn't budged? In fact, it's gone down to the lowest level it's been since 1980. Why is that? You need to know that. How does tax policy affect the adoption of solar technologies? How much money is given in subsidies to nuclear power or to oil or to cars, to all the other sources of energy? We need a level playing field. We're not going to get it level unless we pay attention to the way public policy happens and we get as good at understanding public policy as, say, the religious right did about abortion policy. Second, we need to get unified. We can't be divided up into thousands of little organizations and ever get where we want to get. I love Ralph Nader. But if you talk to him, tell him not to run in 2004. Don't confuse people. I want a green agenda, but we're not going to get it in one fell swoop. We're going to get it in small steps. It isn't going to be big, and Ralph was wrong in 2000. Gore and Bush weren't the same thing. That is just a historical mistake. We need to unify. I love Ralph Nader. if he could be elected president, I would vote for him. If he could run on the Democratic ticket, I certainly would vote for him. But we need to unify. Number three, we need to get money out of politics, and we're not going to get a solar revolution until we attack campaign finance reform. And I don't mean just to limit this campaign contribution or another one or just soft money. I mean federally funded elections. We pay for it anyway. We might as well pay up front. And while we're at it, let's address the World Trade Organization. How was it that we've lost control of our public policy, that laws passed by our state legislatures or the federal legislature can be declared null and void because some people meeting in secret in Geneva, the names of which we don't even know, deliberating by a process we don't understand and never see, can overturn what we do in this country? That's money in politics. But we'll have to also have a vision of an international world that works, and that vision has not been created yet, and that needs to include a policy for security. How do we make a world that is genuinely secure for everybody, not just for Americans? We can't build a wall high enough or big enough or a ceiling sturdy enough to keep all the threats out. We have to make a world in which people, everyone, doesn't feel threatened. Number five, I don't know, let me see how many of you are registered voters. Hold your hand up. How many of you vote? Hold your hands up. Pretty high percentage. You know, the national numbers are that about 40% of people on the progressive side of American politics do not vote. 40% of people who would think a lot like we do don't turn out. We've got to get people registered. We've got to get them into politics. We've got to get them out to the voting booth. We've got to be political in a very direct kind of way. I've got a sixth suggestion, and this is said with some misgivings. We've got to learn from the right wing in American politics without becoming like the right wing. We can't get as nasty as Bill O'Reilly, but neither should we let him off the hook. You've seen Al Franken's new book coming out. Fox gave it some terrific publicity. My hunch is that Franken paid Fox to file the lawsuit. But anyway, it appears that it's over. But there is a lot of misinformation, which is a nice word to call it lies, about what's happening in this country and why it's happening. We need a conservative part of American politics, but we need a genuinely conservative part of American politics. The word conservation and the word conservative need to be joined in the way that Teddy Roosevelt once joined them. Yeah. I've got two other suggestions, and I want to stop. Read the Constitution. Go back and read it. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, and it goes on and talks about due process. The word posterity is mentioned in the preamble. It's the only time the word posterity is mentioned, but it's there. Due process is mentioned in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. Read the Constitution. Why should we not have a constitutional amendment that guarantees the right to a decent environment to all Americans? Why? The last attempt to amend the Constitution to put an environmental clause in as an amendment was 1970. We need that amendment. That is a basic right. And while we're at it, we ought to extend the same basic protection to our posterity. They have rights that we are stripping away from them day by day. The longer that fossil fuel energy system, and nuclear as well, as long as that stays intact, we're robbing our future generations. Now, finally, my last suggestion is simply this. We need to pay attention. I don't know how you read the election of 2000 and the events subsequent to it, but my hunch is, based on what I read from the Project for New American Century and so forth, is when 9/11 happened, the outpouring of grief and quite legitimate patriotism, that was legitimate, but it was corrupted and it was used by people who reportedly, by good reports, by authentic reports, said that what this country needs is another Pearl Harbor. When it happened, they got it. They smelled opportunity. The fires weren't out. The fires actually had just begun when they smelled opportunity. And the idea of invading Iraq was mentioned apparently the next day in the White House on 9/12, with no evidentiary bridge between that event and that solution. We need to pay attention. From my perspective, we're ready. We're almost at the threshold of losing this country. The election of, or the selection of 2000 was a coup that needs to be undone. And it will be. If you get real quiet, you can hear a rumbling out there. People like you and me are ready. Revolution may be not quite the right word, but we're ready for change. Get real quiet. You can hear the stirrings of change. It's coming. Thank you.
Hi, this is Starhawk, and I'm hoping that you'll listen to this and really support Radio for Peace International. It's completely listener-supported, and it's our global community forum.
My name is Remedy, and I sat in an ancient redwood tree for 1 year without touching the ground, and I support Radio for Peace International, the voice of the people from Costa Rica.
You are listening to a speech by David Orr at the 2003 Soul Fest. 2003 Soul Fest was covered by Radio for Peace International. Radio for Peace International broadcasts on international shortwave 7445, messages of hope and inspiration, and the progressive voice of shortwave. You can find out more about Radio for Peace International or the Institute for Progressive Communications, the radio production courses taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace International, by going to www.rfpi.org. Again, that's www.rfpi.org. We now return to David Orr's speech at the 2003 Soul Fest.
This is Jim Page, and you are listening to Radio for Peace International from Costa Rica.
Floor is yours. Questions? We turned the power back on in Ohio. It's been a bad summer for First Energy Corporation. They're the owners of Davis Bessie, the nuclear power plant I mentioned, and it was their power line that apparently triggered the blackout. But why do we have a power system that is one dumb mistake away from blackouts? We've got the power back on. Thanks. What I think of Dennis Kucinich. I like Dennis. I think his role is to push American politics back into the center. Now, if you pay attention to American politics, do you remember in the 1970s when you had people like Frank Church in the Senate and George McGovern? There was a progressive side of American politics, and what happened was American politics shifted this way to the right. And it shifted roughly in tandem with income distribution. So as tax policy was favoring the very top strata of income folks, American politics shifted. We don't have a progressive side of American politics. Now, I like Tom Daschle. Don't know him, but I like what I hear of him. But is Tom Daschle a progressive? I don't think so. We don't have a progressive side of American politics. Dennis Kucinich represents that side. And I would hope that Dennis drives the debate in American politics back into something that looks more like a center. Can he be elected president? No. You think so? We're just down to audience participation. We'll just take a straw poll right here. I don't want to say that. Let's get more questions here. I had one back, yeah. Green shirt. Well, good question. Thanks for asking it. It's a lot easier to say what we need than how we do it. We can't do it if only 49-point-something-other% of people show up at presidential elections. We can't do it if the young people who are 18 to 25 vote at the 15% level. We can't do it as long as people who are disadvantaged by the system are forced out of politics. We can't do it if in Florida 70,000 people were systematically removed from the voting rolls in 2000. Read Greg Palast's description of how that came about in a book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. But this will have to be done legislatively. It'll have to be done federally. Probably Bush might say it. I mean, he says a lot of things. Way in the back. Well, you're making a really good point. If we have another hour, let me talk to you about the history of American political parties. We have two parties because we have a winner-take-all electoral system. And the Democratic Party may go into oblivion. The Whig Party went into oblivion. There are parties that have come and gone. But I think at this point, probably the best from my standpoint, and I certainly understand what you're saying, the best solution would be for the Democratic Party to become really a party again, an opposition party. Now, I don't know what happened to the Democratic Party's backbone, but it disappeared sometime from the 1960s through the, 1990s. And a level of thuggery began to occur in American politics when Tom DeLay. Do you all know Tom DeLay? When Tom DeLay and Trent Lott set their senior staffers down to intimidate vote counters in Miami-Dade County in 2000, we crossed a threshold of sorts, and it wasn't a happy event. Now, I don't know how we reformed the party system. I still am not ready to jump out of the Democratic Party yet. I want to stay with the two-party system for a time. Third parties can drive the electoral process in different directions. The progressives did it, the populists did it in the early part of the 20th century. It took 20 years to make real changes happen. We don't have that much time now. But your opinion is a good opinion. Thanks for saying that. Let's come back to this side over here. Yeah.
Yeah, on that same subject,
perhaps. Good point. Thanks for that. I have it over here. What I think about the recall. Next question. Y'all don't seem to like, if I read the polls correctly, Gray Davis. The question is whether you recall somebody in the middle of a term for no just cause. Now, there's a difference between impeachment for just cause and a recall vote that could be done on a whim. How many of you are actually running in this... 2/3 of you are running. The winning margin is going to be 3 votes. I don't know. What do you all think of the recall? Well, I think you all need to be active and make your voices heard because it's... And I don't really want Arnold Schwarzenegger in there. I don't care who he's married to. Down front here. This will take up to about 3 o'clock. I need to stumble around until I can think of something smart to say here for just a minute. But, in a parliamentary system or a multi-party system, you have proportional representation. And so if the socialists get 8% of the vote, they get 8% of the seats. And that's sometimes a good way to do that. Then you end up forming coalitions and all that. I don't know. Let me leave the question hanging, but let me make my response somewhat peripheral here. If you ask somebody, when was the last really creative thing or period in American politics, when would you say it would be? Teddy Roosevelt? Or back all the way back to the early part of the 19th century, the invention of political parties, maybe, or the caucuses and so forth. Anyway, what the point is, it was a long time ago. Why don't we become as creative socially and politically as we are technologically? Our creativity goes over here to our gadgets, our artifacts, and these prosthetic devices like computers and so forth, but not to how we handle our public business. So I don't know what the right way. There is no right way. In certain sense, there are a lot of different systems. But dumb people can't make a good system work. Genuine patriots can make a pretty mediocre system work very well. But it means we have to be active. We have to be out there. We have to be in the political process. And a lot of this is a matter of good judgment in politics and being informed. It scares me that people think weapons, 42% of the American public think weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. 42% or 45% believe that Iraq was behind 9/11. And these are our neighbors. These are the people you pass as you shop at Walmart. We've got a pattern here. That worries me a lot, yeah. Good point. Thank you for raising that. Did everybody hear the point? After 2000, there was a lot of talk about reforming the vote counting system and going to electronic computerized vote counting, whereas no paper trail is a scary thing. Nancy Pelosi got an email I saw several months ago from Peter Coyote describing this and describing the ownership of some of these companies by right-wing Republicans. And so once again, transparency is lost. And this is something, this is a major issue. Thank you very much for raising that point. I don't have an answer for it, except I like the paper ballots, so you can go back and recount them. And it is a system you can see what actually happened. Yell shirt? Why not? I agree. It's kind of like an appendix in a human body. It's whatever its function once was, which we don't know, its time has passed. Yeah, I would. If you run on that ticket, I'll support you. Unless somebody's running on campaign finance reform, and I'll support them. Down here.
Okay. Hi, this is Debbie Mitels. I'm the outreach director for the Foundation for Global Community in Palo Alto, California, and I support the work of the Radio for Peace International. They are the global community forum broadcasting from Costa Rica.
You are listening to Radio for Peace International and a speech by David Orr, given at the 2003 Soul Fest in Hopland, California. Radio for Peace International is facing a lockout similar to the one faced by Pacifica not too long ago. To find out how you can help or support Radio for Peace International, log on to our website at www.rfpi.org. www.rfpi.org. And now back to David Orr.
Well, in my case, it's just genetic. I mean, I'm a reader. And it's a problem. Did all of you hear the point? Young man, what's your name?
Jeffrey Weiss
says that I threw out a lot of statistics and want you to read all these books and so forth, which I do. But we're just buried in information. It's kind of like wanting a drink of water and standing under Niagara Falls with a tin cup. And you just want you want the right information. One of the tricks, let me say three things. One is learn how to be selectively ignorant. Know all the things you don't need to know anything about. We are distracted. I mean, talk about weapons of mass distraction, somebody once put it. We are distracted. We are over-entertained, and we are not the nation of readers that we once were. Now, let me compare just one thing. Jeffrey, this is a good question. Thanks for asking this, or points you're making. Go back in your American history, here comes another date, 1858, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. There were eight of them. The issues at that point were sectionalism, the tariff, and, of course, slavery. And in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln and Douglas, go back and read the transcript, hashed it out for a crowd not of a few hundred, but for thousands of people. No PA system. And if you read the transcript, it was full of allusions to classical this, and there was a structured argument. Imagine structured arguments in politics. No sound bites. And the audience followed it. They clapped. They jeered. They applauded. They were following those ideas. They took those ideas seriously enough that some of those people fought for those ideas. Some of them died for those ideas a few years later. They were citizens. They were readers. The literacy rate, if I follow John Taylor Gatto's point, the literacy rate was higher then, before compulsory schooling in many states, than it is now. My last point is simply this. You're not going to find out about the world watching television. You won't. You have to search farther and wider and dig deeper. You've got to go get online. If you want to follow the assassination last week of the journalist with the shoulder-mounted camera, read the Manchester Guardian's view of that online of what actually happened and the New York Times view. You've got to dig deeper. It's harder to be a citizen now. You can't be a good citizen unless you read. And think of all the things you have to know about. Genetic engineering, nanotechnologies, artificial intelligence. We have to know more now. To be a citizen now in a highly technological society is a hard thing to do. It just requires lots of effort and lots of time. And I don't do, there's no magic bullet. There's no one journal. You can't just read the Utney Reader and know everything you need to know. You've got to have multiple sources of information. But my last point I'd add to this is this. If education does anything or ought to do anything, it ought to give us what somebody once called a bullshit detector. And when you hear it, you ought to recognize it for what it is. And it requires we paid attention and we just realize that something here doesn't add up. Now, let me be Bash Bush one more time. I think he has attention deficit disorder. I think he goes from thing to thing to thing. Whether you like him or dislike him, I think you have to be somewhat upset by the fact that we go from things so quickly with no evidentiary trail, no logic, there's no bridge. That ought to worry us. But we ought to be able to see that if we're properly educated. Hand up in the back. Wait, what I think about? Well, good question. E.F. Schumacher's classic book, Small is Beautiful, didn't make the case for small everywhere and always. He made a case for what he called appropriate scale. And there are some things which the appropriate scale is large. There are lots of things the appropriate scale is small. And then there are lots of large ways to link small ways. All of you have, or most of you have, notebook computers. You're linked via the internet and so forth. You're networked, but we have a distributed computing system. Most of you don't have mainframe computer. You couldn't haul it around. Distributed energy systems make perfectly good sense. So what you see around here makes implicitly good sense, and it makes good design sense. If it fails, it'll fail gracefully. There's no way if a solar collector goes offline or something happens or falls through the roof, no particular big deal because that doesn't do anything to your neighbor. And so the system has a degree of resilience and integrity, but we've known this for a long time. Why is that not energy policy? If you get honest with prices, we move food on average about 1,500 miles from where it's grown or produced to where it's eaten. You can do that, fine, as long as you subsidize fossil fuels and you're putting in about 11 or 12 calories of fossil energy to get one calorie on a plate. You can do that, and that's fine, until you have to pay the full cost of it. And in Ohio, we've disinvested in agriculture in Ohio, so we import lots and lots of food from California and from Mexico, from all around the world. You go to supermarkets, you see food move, you know, long, long distances. And that's probably okay for lots of things, but a decentralized agricultural system as the core of a food system would make a lot of sense. So I don't think there's one size fits all kind of answer, but there are ways to think about appropriate scale. But thanks for asking the question or making that point. That's a good one. question is the electrical grid like a Model T? Well, sure it is. And when we decentralized or deregulated the electric business, we separated transmission from generation. And the money, as you all in California, was in generation. You could game that system. And you all were game to the tune of, what, $30 billion? You'll never see that again. And so you were ripped off by the likes of Duke Power and so forth. It's a lot harder to game transmission. It's a whole different kind of thing. So transmission has gone begging. We haven't put the investment in it for the past 20 years. But there should be a national policy to make a grid something like we have the internet. So it becomes an interconnective tissue that collects lots of distributed energy systems. Windmills here and a photovoltaic array there and a microturbine here and lots of different ways to think about the grid that make a lot of good sense. But that again requires a public that understands these issues. You know, we were sold a bill of good. When we got free market this and free market that, markets do some things. There are some things markets can't do and won't do, especially where democracy that is supposed to be a part of that is so clouded and corrupted. If democracy is transparent, you can go further down the deregulatory road, but that's not the kind of system that we have right now. Now, you've all been a good audience. Thank you for your time and attention. Julia's come down from the tree, so she's the next one. Thank you very much.
This is Julia Butterfly Hill with listener-supported radio for Peace International, your global community forum.
This is Michael Bedar, producer and director of Bailagua and Ecoparque. I'm here at Soulfest, and I support the work of Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from Costa Rica.
Hi, this is Scott Faracher with Allison Thompson. Radio for Peace International covered the 2003 Soulfest in Joplin, California. This is David Orr's speech at the 2003 Soulfest. Radio for Peace International broadcast messages of hope on international shortwave from Costa Rica. You can access Radio for Peace International and see how you can support Radio for Peace or find out more about the IPC, Institute for Progressive Communications, courses taught on the grounds of Radio for Peace International at the Radio for Peace website, and that is www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. Radio for Peace International would like to thank Soulfest for all their help in making these recordings possible and for all the wonderful interviews that they helped set up.
Hi, this is Brian Welch, publisher of Mother Earth News, and I'd like to say that we think the work that Radio for Peace is doing is terrific. We're glad to have them on our airwaves.